Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Bubalo, and I'm a non-resident fellow here at the Lowy Institute.
That wasn't always a spare time job here. Up until fairly recently, I was a fixture of this building for about 15 years, or 10 years in this building and 5 down the road. So it's great to be back here at the Lowy Institute. I feel a bit like a fading 60s pop icon that they kind of bring back occasionally. They trot out to do events, but it is that's no reflection of the guest that we have tonight. It's really an honour to be introducing such a distinguished individual as Cressida Dick, CBE QPM. Cressida's formal title is the Commissioner of Police of the Metropolis. I have to say there is something a little Batman-esque about the title, although of course we are talking more Bobbies than Batman tonight. Now, there's no more iconic nor recognisable police than the British Bobby, from the distinctive helmet to the swinging truncheon. There's a lot of history in that uniform, but at the same time, the image does not perhaps accurately reflect the myriad ways that the Met is now a very modern police force. And we certainly see that in the Commissioner's choice of topic this evening. Police licensed to operate in the digital age, a UK perspective. What the Commissioner will grapple with tonight are the challenges and opportunities that modern technology, especially digitisation, present for both police and for criminals. Specifically, the Commissioner will be discussing something that a range of organisations are now grappling with, from intelligence agencies to the private sector. How do you manage the tension between protecting citizen safety on the one hand and protecting their data on the other? It's hard to think of a better police officer, indeed better individual, to take us through this tricky subject. In fact, the moment I agreed to host tonight, I've been inundated by unsolicited praise for Cressida, including from any Brit expat in the 5-mile vicinity. This reflects the very high regard in which she is held, not just as a police officer, but also as a public figure. Cressida has spent 35 years in public service. She's held very senior leadership roles in each of the organisations she's worked for, the Metropolitan Police Service, the Thames Valley Police, the National Police College, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. She's overseen a wide variety of high-profile and complex policing investigations, from serious and organised crime to counter-terrorism. She led on security preparations for the 2012 London Olympics and Paralympics and the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations. She had a leading role in the evolution of the counter-terrorism police network. In February 2017, Cressida was appointed Commissioner of Police of the Metropolis, the first female commissioner in the Met's history, and now leads the UK's largest police service. So, ladies and gentlemen, turn off your phones, get prepared for a real treat. Please join me in welcoming the Commissioner.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for that warm introduction. I am absolutely delighted to be here in Sydney and also here at the Institute. And I feel very privileged to have been invited to speak tonight. You've heard my topic, and I'll probably speak for about 20, 25 minutes, and then I think we'll go into a question session. If you find my topic really dull, fine. You don't have to stay, of course. But if you do stay and then you then want to ask a question about anything that you think I might have something useful to say on, then please do. Don't feel constrained by the talk. But I have been, as you've heard, the Commissioner of the Met, working out of Scotland Yard for 2.5 years. And I do believe that, as with so many other, probably just about all other organisations, the challenges and the exciting opportunities of the digital age are so extraordinary. And I feel very lucky to be the Commissioner, despite some of the challenges, during this particular time. And I am convinced that in, say, 2030, people will look back and say, my goodness, policing, law enforcement changed a lot at the end of the decade we're in now and in the early days of the next decade. And whatever other things are going on, and you will be reading about a lot of activity involving the Metropolitan Police in London, perhaps, if you follow UK affairs at all, I do see one of my main jobs as commissioner is to help the Met transform for the digital age. We are, as you've heard, a pretty ancient institution. We're just about to approach our 190th birthday. And as I look back, frankly, I think it's quite remarkable to see what has not changed, actually, in policing in that time. In particular, what I would call some of our founding principles, founded as we were by Sir Robert Peel, and hence the phrase Peelers, and his first two commissioners, Rowan and Main. Their principles in the digital age remain broadly very relevant. So, for example, they talked about the prevention of crime being fundamental, that the police are only merely citizens in uniform, not spies or members of the military, that the powers we hold should only be used sparingly and strictly when necessary. And then, if I look back over my 36, you were a bit generous there, 36 years, I think, since I began on patrol on the streets of Soho in the West End of London, of course I'm struck by what has changed, and I'll come to that, but I'm also struck by how the essential ingredients of what we call the job, in inverted commas, are very similar. We are still the emergency service of last resort. People need us at the worst of times. They ask for help in the same sorts of pickles and disputes. They expect us in the same kind of way as when I joined, to be present, to be reliable, to be visible, to be with them at events, at protests. You'll know that London probably has more events and protests, both than any other city in the world, at celebrations. And of course, some people continue to be motivated for age-old reasons to contravene the law, to steal, to assault, to exploit, to harass, to terrorise, to break traffic and other regulations. And I say this because I often go out on patrol with my guys and girls, and I often sit next to the call handlers. In many respects, the stuff of the job, the nature of policing doesn't really change that much. But, of course, some things have changed immeasurably in my 36 years. Firstly, to speak for the Met, I would say we are very much more accountable. We are very much more regulated. We are very much more transparent. I think we are a bit more humble in a good way. We're not arrogant. We are very much more scrutinized in 101 ways. We are very diverse compared with what we once were. And I would say, with no disrespect to my much-loved colleagues from 1983, I would say we are professional in a way that actually I would hardly have believed possible when I started in 1983. So there's a whole set of changes there, of transformations, I believe. And then the second major set of changes has been because of technology. Technological revolution has given us extraordinary tools for crime investigation and indeed prevention. In 1983, I had access to criminal records and fingerprints, which were kept on a microfiche system, if anybody remembers what they were. Centrally, I had to ring up for them. Intelligence, such as it was collated on index cards, locally mostly, they were usually handwritten, occasionally only typed. DNA as a tool for criminal investigation hadn't been thought of when I started. If you had a serious crime scene, you wanted to take an image of it, you had to call for a photographer. I could go on. But now, as you'll be well aware, I'm sure, all my officers on patrol have body-worn video. That's 22,000 of them. They record scenes, they record interactions, arrests. They can check suspects' fingerprints, mobile, a device invented actually by people in the Met in a very quick time. They can speak on a national communication system, overt and covert, used by multiple agencies, not just policing. They can check UK and European criminal records immediately. They don't even know they're doing it. Usually when they make a check, they'll be checking many databases from their tablets. Their investigations will routinely involve CCTV. We have a lot of automatic number plate recognition. Likewise, very frequently comms data, communications data, videos uploaded by witnesses, often the content of suspects' or victims' phones, sometimes financial or other data. And because London is such an international and I think probably the most diverse city on the planet, although I know one or two people in the room may argue about that, many of our suspects and our victims and our evidence are located in all sorts of different places. And of course, increasingly, the data we want or need to conduct our lawful duties is overseas as well. Technology has given us extraordinary opportunities to interact with our public in a different way, to identify more offenders, to find people who are missing or fugitives, to protect life, to protect property, to prove associations, motivations, and so forth. An important other real advantage, I think, is that the integrity of our evidence and the legitimacy of the police, therefore, has been improved, in my view, by technology. The hazards that police services around the world in all eras have to keep their eyes and ears out for, unfair trials, miscarriages of justice, corruption, these are all made very much less likely because of technology. But as we have adopted new technologies, obviously so have criminals. And you all know this. I know there's some experts in the room, but everybody knows this. Whether to commit totally new forms of crime, like cyber, or by using modern methods to commit old-fashioned crimes, bullying, deception, theft, just general nastiness, for sexual pleasure, to groom the vulnerable, to spread terrorist ideology, using modern methods to do old-fashioned things. And in the digital age, the challenge is for us to make data and other technological possibilities more of an advantage for us. Broadly speaking, I call us the good guys, than it is for the criminal, the hostile state, the terrorist. I think even the most forward-looking and well-resourced police service in the world would admit that they have struggled to keep up to date, to develop the skills, the thinking, the capacity, and the capabilities that we need. And of course, these struggles aren't unique to policing, to law enforcement or security. This is across so many organizations. We are all having to reinvent ourselves. And other organizations like ours don't have the luxury of getting out of an area of business. You know, we can't say, well, we're not going to deal with burglary anymore and we're going to be more like a tech startup. No, we've got to carry on dealing with burglary investigation. We're going to have to refuel in flight. Our other demands have either remained or increased in the main. We have some choices, but we have fewer choices perhaps than some organizations do. But many organizations are wrestling with needing to transform for the digital age, but sitting on large, old, costly legacy systems, for example, data that isn't clean, data that isn't organized in the way we would like. Most are now facing the extraordinary reality of ever-increasing volumes, exponential, people say, volumes of data, and the also sometimes people say exponential increasing pace of change. So that's common to so many of our organizations in the modern world. But I do think there are some things which are particular to law enforcement, and I'd like to just talk about those briefly. Generally speaking, people talk about the challenges of the digital age as volume, variety, velocity of change, complexity. So if I frame it around that for law enforcement, let's go back to 2005. You will remember the terrible, terrible terrorist attacks that were suffered in London then. In all the investigations into the 7/7 attacks, we seized, I think, a total of 4 terabytes of data. one of our counter-terrorist investigations running currently, just one and not an particularly unusual one, has 81 terabytes of data. 90% of adults in London have smartphones. The average London household has 10 data devices. One device has 50,000 data items that we might be interested in. Most crimes have a digital element. Most investigations require accessing data in multiple locations. And criminals communicate sometimes across multiple encrypted platforms, often simultaneously, making identification or analysis of relevant content very challenging. Now, for those of you who are technically minded, those terabytes might not sound so much. They're not, compared with what some industries are wrestling with. The difference for us, I think, is that it's not just about volume, it's volume and complexity. So I've touched on one aspect of complexity. The internet has created a different relationship between victims and offenders. When I started, we pretty much knew most of our offenders, and our victims tended to be there, and we could contact them again very quickly. Now, crimes have multiple offenders, different places, often different jurisdictions, victims in different places again, different jurisdictions, data, different places again. So that's one aspect of complexity. But also the nature of the data we look at compared with some other sectors and the questions we have to ask of it are complex. We deal with a very broad range of data sources by anybody's standards. And the public have an expectation that we will look at them all. We'll be able to identify the risk and find the missing thing, receive, exploit any data that informs our ability to safeguard them. We could debate some of that, but broadly speaking, we have to try to understand how we can ingest, understand, and exploit all forms of data. And of course, data is now coming in all sorts of different formats. And London, being a relatively early adopter of some things, doesn't always help us. So many of you will have seen the CCTV density in London. There's no other, well, there are one or two now, but very few cities in the world that have the same density of CCTV. Would it surprise you to know that some of those are archaic systems and some are state of the art? So we have to be able to ingest 2,000 different formats of CCTV just to start us. Sometimes the question we want to ask in law enforcement is quite simple. Can we identify a telephone number? Can we find an IP address or a particular image? But more complex questions are very, very fundamental for us. The most relevant and highly sort of topical at the moment in the UK is, do we hold data that undermines the case for the prosecution? The so-called disclosure challenge. Is there exculpatory material? That could take any form, but it's, the one that people are very focused on for us at the moment is previous communication between suspects and victims, sometimes with third parties, particularly where you were talking about crimes like rape, allegations of domestic violence and human trafficking, where once a conversation would have been forgotten or at best partially remembered by one or more parties, there's now a record, a digital record. It's going to be kept forever. It may be published immediately and widely. Remember also the UK at the moment is the most socially networked country in the world. Everybody is talking to each other on social networks. So also remember in London, not unique, but a very large proportion of those conversations may require translation into English, particularly if you're talking about something like human trafficking. You want to examine a relationship which goes back months and months and months and months and months, and the defense will absolutely say, we need to understand this, what went on, every single word of Romanian, say, which is particularly common for us in sex trafficking, needs to be translated. You'll also be familiar with the challenges of encryption. Harder, more expensive, sometimes completely impossible for law enforcement to access data. Equally, passwords may be withheld, victims deceased, multiple devices found, attribution difficult. Increasing numbers of apps now protect data at rest as well as data in transit. So sophisticated and not so sophisticated for criminals, frankly, seek to escape discovery, identification, justice through encryption and use of the dark web. And I think as we look forward, we can probably presume that you know, as sensors, objects, devices, AI-based algorithms are incorporated into all our, you know, I'm sort of looking at my clothing here, our digital environment, whatever that may be, then more robust and easy to use technologies will probably be incorporated at the same time to increase privacy, trust and control, creating greater challenges for those in law enforcement and national security. Finally, I'll just quickly mention velocity. For all its wonderful benefits, the internet has massively reduced time, relevant times for us. The time it takes for someone to be groomed or radicalized, the time for a conspiracy to be created, for enablers such as money or component parts for an IED to be accessed, for lessons to be absorbed by criminals and terrorists, for tactics, new tactics and weapons to be developed, for inspiration to turn into action. It's so much easier and quicker now for what used to be just frustration to turn into harassment, hate crime, or a calling to protest or disorder. Just before I flew out here, Mr. Johnson, our Prime Minister, made an announcement which, you know, surprised a few people. And his back door is pretty much opposite my back door. And less than a couple of hours later, we had 3,000 people on the street in Whitehall, outside Downing Street and outside Parliament. And they stayed about 6 hours in the evening. And it could have gone up a lot higher if it was a different type of issue. Never would have happened 10 years ago. Just couldn't have. Social media allows people to say, well, let's come out and protest. Time for a tiff to turn into an argument, something we're seeing a lot in our street violence, our serious violence, you know, now can turn in not just an argument, but a fight and a murder. Drugs deal can be made, delivered from anywhere to anywhere very quickly. So this all creates extra pressure on us, particularly sometimes to intervene earlier. I'm thinking particularly here of high risk things like terrorism. You know things are going to happen faster. That terrible phrase, flash to bang, is just compressed. And if somebody takes it into their head, they may be able to actually do something very, very fast. Therefore, we intervene earlier, or we put greater surveillance on. First is risky, may mean we don't get the evidence, may not be able to bring somebody to justice, is risky in other ways, and the second is very expensive. And as you are all aware, new and emerging technologies are coming on to the market all the time and being refined. So, you know, you will have read perhaps about the UK wrestling with drones around one of our airports earlier in the year, both two of our airports actually. Drones, you know, great uses, fantastic. I heard about drones here being used to, you know, rescue somebody from the ocean. Wonderful. Also, you know, being used in the UK to put illicit goods into prison and countless other illicit activities. As we go forward, autonomous vehicles, robots, AI, they're going to pose new challenges for law enforcement. So if a machine kills someone, who's going to be held to account? How do we have the audit trail that allows the killer or at least the responsible person to be identified and brought to justice? So far I've been talking about sort of opportunities and challenges that are mainly practical. But in many respects, I believe the greater challenges are legal and ethical. How can our legal systems domestically and internationally keep pace with technological changes? And I'm fascinated in my week in Australia to understand how you have been approaching that here. And I know there have been some really powerful things happening. My take on it is that policing in democracies relies fundamentally on trust. The citizen must trust that the police will be effective when they ask for help, that we will act selflessly and with determination and courage, protect them, that we will be reasonably efficient, that we will be fair, compassionate and humane, that we will not abuse the power we have or the information they give us. Without citizens' trust, we can't do our jobs. We don't get intelligence, we don't get evidence, we don't have cooperation or support. We struggle to recruit without citizens' trust. And if we do have staff and low citizens' trust, the staff feel isolated, they feel alienated, they feel conflicted, and they feel demoralised. I'm glad to say that's not the case for the Met. Any of you thinking of visiting London soon, the Met is full of bright, capable, ingenious, highly motivated people who are very professional. And I think they genuinely, I would say this, wouldn't I, but they exemplify our quite old-fashioned modern values of courage, of integrity, of professionalism, of compassion every day. And we are recruiting now, growing like mad. If any of you think you're moving to London, want to become one of us, and recruitment is good. Despite it, the fact that it is often said that public trust in the state and in institutions is, you know, bombing, nosediving, I'd have to say trust in the police in the UK is holding up really quite well. I won't go in for cheap comparisons with some other professions, but you can imagine who I might be referring to. Trust in policing is very, very high. And that's despite the fact that, as many of you will know, in the last 5 or 6 years, police budgets have been severely constrained. My own service has had about £800 million taken out of its budgets. We are now very recently told that we are heading back up in a very exciting way, so that will be great. But we've lost that money at the time of increased demands and expectations, various sorts, and yet public trust holds up. And I think that says something about, you know, of course, our ethos, our history, but it says something about our character and our professionalism, I guess. But in this context, I think the biggest risk to public trust lies in the next decade for the Met and maybe elsewhere from the possibilities of data and the ethical challenges therein. So one huge and obvious risk is that we don't actually grasp the possibilities, that we sit here with sitting on our hands and become increasingly ineffective and inefficient. I don't intend for that to happen. I don't think my government does either. But it could happen because there are such fiendish ethical challenges in some of the new technologies. And we have to grasp these ethical nettles, in my view. And on occasion, we have to challenge or regulate new technologies. Equally, the public trust could go down hugely if we fail, as Anthony mentioned at the beginning, to protect people's private, lawful data that we have lawfully obtained. And in every country in the world, we've seen losses of data. I'm pleased to say, thus far, in any significant way in the modern time from the Met, but losses can occur for all sorts of reasons. You know, you have hackers, not just of your own system, but hackers of partners or suppliers, by an activist, an attention seeker, a terrorist, a hostile state. Deliberate loss by a disgruntled employee or a greedy, dishonest employee. It can happen by accident. It can happen in the course of well-intentioned sharing designed to reduce the risk of somebody committing a crime or to safeguard somebody. Subsequently, there can be a data loss. And this is all made more complex by the fact that in our disrupted world, it seems that so many people, perhaps generalising a bit here, but particularly the young, inverted commas, have little care, actually, in some respects, for their personal data and don't protect it or treat it in the way that some others do. Others are hugely protective of it. What I can say, and I'm not sure about the situation here, so forgive me, but in the UK and in Europe, our legislators have taken a very, very strong line. Any ethical dilemmas are rather reduced because we are just under very, very strong legal obligations in relation to retention, storage, deletion, and security of data. We must do our absolute best to prevent breaches. And if we do have a breach, there's enormous great consequences for our organizations. So I think the ethical, I'm not complacent about that, by the way, far from it, but the ethical questions center more largely around, as Anthony said, the privacy versus security debate. How intrusive should we be in the pursuit of our lawful purposes? And I'm deeply conscious here that different cultures, different countries have very different histories and approaches to this issue. So I know I'm going to be talking very much from a UK and London perspective. But it's worth just pausing there. I talked about CCTV and the density of it in London, and ANPR, very high, Broadly speaking, it may surprise some of you to know, the only questions we get about that are, can we have some more, please? So citizens feeling they want more CCTV in their backyard, so to speak. And equally, our most intrusive use of techniques, such as interception of communications, even human surveillance by police, as here, I'm sure, very, very highly regulated. But we're now tiptoeing into the world of robotics, of machine learning, of artificial intelligence. We're only tiptoeing, and of course some of our adversaries are taking giant steps. They're not hindered in the same way quite properly that we are constrained. Often, of course, the private sector are able, thank God, to take larger steps sometimes than the public sector can. So for us, some of these tiptoed steps seem quite uncontroversial. Nobody seems to get too excited about us using machines to start helping us to deal with calls for help or how we prioritise our work. In our back offices, of course, nobody's too worried. The next step, perhaps, broadly might be what's called predictive policing. People are starting to get worried about that. In parts, the likely, trying to assess using modern technologies, the likely risks that a person or a set of people or a place may present, a bit more contested, particularly because of the potential for bias within those systems, either in the data or in the algorithm. And the highest profile at the moment, hot potato in the UK, is live facial recognition. A technology that has been used, trialled by some police services, a couple in the UK, including my own, to support human decision-making. Currently, South Wales Police, old South Wales Police, if I might call them that for these purposes, are subject to a judicial review, and we're expecting the outcome of that sometime in the next few weeks and months. So it will be really interesting to see what our courts say about the use of live facial recognition. So far I've talked about challenges. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the principles that might assist with these ethical dilemmas so that we can maintain public trust and make best use of technologies and not sleepwalk into some kind of ghastly Orwellian omniscient police state. Firstly, I think we can think of intrusion into privacy as we do in the Met about the use of force, something I think Sir Robert Peel would probably approve of. So when we're thinking about the use of force, we start thinking about the principle of escalation. We always begin at the lowest possible level of use of force, and I would suggest, therefore, data intrusion, and we only escalate if it's needed from that point. In the Met today, as you all know, most officers are unarmed, and when dealing with somebody who might be violent, the start point is almost always a conversation, not drawing a firearm. In our exploitation of data, we should follow the same approach. Use minimal intrusion wherever possible and only escalate from that point where needed. Secondly, the principle of developing sufficient scope in our capabilities. Whilst our use of force model may often begin with a conversation, we have the capacity to escalate our use of force all the way through to a specialist firearms team very quickly if needed. And it's that breadth of capability that gives the public and our officers reassurance that we can respond to a wide range of physical threats. I suggest that in our use of data, we need a similar kind of pyramidal model where we can use low intrusion often, but can escalate quickly to high intrusion when required. Thirdly, a principle I might call gearing of our use of force or data. That's to say, having sufficiently tiered capabilities that we can accurately match our response to the risk posed. And for us in the use of force, Taser is a very good example of this. The use, Taser's, you know, not used tremendously often in the Met, but quite a lot now. And they can use relatively little force because in the vast majority of occasions, it's just the red dot. I point the taser and the person says, okay, fine. 83% of the time, I think. In fact, in 92% of the times we use taser, we don't actually fire the taser. But even if we do, if you're faced with a life-threatening level of violence, that's clearly a proportionate thing to do, and it's very accurate. So we need to be able to say, do the same kind of thing in data. Be accurate, minimise intrusion, unnecessary intrusion to the suspect and indeed to the wider public, what you might call collateral intrusion. And finally, agility. We need to be able to escalate and de-escalate the use of force and data quickly and in line with the threat. We need to minimise a lag in time between a shift in threat and our level of intrusion. If we're too slow to escalate, we won't, you know, safeguard the public. If we're too slow to de-escalate, we inappropriately impact the rights of the suspect and the wider public. Our use of force model has evolved, you know, over the last 190 years. It's kind of based on our laws and our values, and it's also based on continuous engagement with our communities. And in the UK, at least, I suggest that we need to think about this engagement in relation to data. A considerable part of all our communications with our public now, to listen, to inform, to build trust, is of course now digital communication. And that requires different effort and expertise from more old-fashioned communications, which we still also do a lot. So we have to be able to align our method of communication with the intended audience. In the Met, you know, if we're looking to recruit technical graduates that have specialist skills we need, we're not going to put an advertisement in a newspaper. We've set up dedicated Slack channels that put undergraduates in direct contact with our technical experts. We need to recognise that the digital age has created new communities, and we have to find new opportunities to engage with those communities effectively. And we have to build some capacity to do that, as with all other aspects of our community engagement. We have to invest in it. You know, to get a really, really powerful set of Twitter followers is, you know, phenomenal. But it can take quite a long time to get, such a proper community that you can use effectively from an investigative or indeed a trust perspective, and that can take ages. So I think that for me, the kind of key principles of maintaining public trust in a digital age in the UK are firstly the one of transparency, which I've touched on a couple of times. We have to have transparent conversations with the public and explain how data has been used, how it could be used in the future. That's got to be early, honest, accurate engagement to build confidence and to get feedback. We need to be as clear as we can about what we propose to do, the method, and of course, why we feel that we should be adopting that method. We have to do this in a way which is comprehensible. It's quite a challenge. We're talking about complex algorithms, don't test me. We have to build clear and concise explanations as to how they work, what data sets they're used against. We can't have lots of black box solutions, certainly in policing in the UK, where our users of our community, you know, our community members don't understand the principles that we're using to gain insights from data. And as I said, it must be proportionate, quite clearly, minimal intrusion in order to safeguard the public. It's going to have to be reviewed far more than possibly ever in the past. In the old days, we could build CCTV systems. Thank you very much. They're going to last for years. We know that modern technologies are going to evolve very fast. Data capabilities will have to evolve with them. That means a different way of thinking about how you govern and hold to account, how we allocate resources, because that's essential work, the maintenance, inverted commas, work. We have to work very hard to tackle what we would call disproportionality, where the use of the data is impacting more adversely on one group than another for no good reason and bias. We should also remember, though, that algorithms could be used to seek out unnecessary disproportionality or inappropriate bias. So it isn't all a sort of negative and one-way street, but it is going to be, for our public, a very, very big issue. And finally, and I, would love to debate this with people, but I feel very strongly that we need to make it clear to our public that the data tools that are new are just a way of enabling our human teams to make better decisions. The final decision must rest with a human being, And that decision maker has to understand the strengths and the weaknesses, the limitations of the tool they are using. And so you will see that I believe fundamentally that in the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, policing will remain a people business where the most valuable interactions and contributions are made by people. And it, you know, it's currently a people business enabled by information, a bit of kit. That's what it will remain. I believe it must remain, otherwise public trust will reduce hugely. This, though, just to conclude, Anthony, is a shared endeavour. This is not a job for the cops. This is a job for policymakers and parliamentarians. They have to step up. I see they have in Australia in many respects, not least, thinking about encryption and a new law there. I'd be really interested to see how that works. In the UK, we have an online harms white paper, which is pretty comprehensive and broad. There's some really great work gone on, not least to get us to the stage of our Investigatory Powers Act from a couple of years ago, which involved huge amounts of consultation and trying to maintain public trust in the use of very intrusive powers by agencies and law enforcement. So policymakers, parliamentarians need to step up, not just to come up with legislation, but to lead the public debate. And they must, you know, recognise that just as we can't arrest our way out of many of the criminal opportunities currently available online, clearly prevention is better than enforcement. If you're talking about fraud, you're talking about child exploitation, whatever it may be. Equally, it shouldn't be us in law enforcement who decide where the appropriate limit of activities should be in the digital world, particularly in relation to intrusion into privacy. So for our public to have trust in us, our work in the data world must be properly, legally circumscribed. There must be checks and balances. Where appropriate, we need independent reviewing or regulating. And we must have firm internal governance and ethical guidance for our people. And I'm pleased to say that in all those fronts in the UK, there are sort of useful things emerging for our people, which will, I think, allow us to go forward into the digital age with some confidence, allow our people to make best use of modern and emerging technologies without either of those two hazards I talked about, of just sort of sitting there and the world changes around us, or doing our best with very good intention and then discovering that actually we have been far more intrusive than the public ever wanted us to be. So I've had a lovely day and a bit in Australia already. I'm here for 5 days. I'm looking forward to discussing these and many other policing and national security issues, practical and ethical, over the next few days. To close, simply to say, I know you know this. You, Australians, are, always will be, genuinely one of our, if not the closest partner that we work with in law enforcement and national security. We're constantly developing capabilities together. We're constantly learning from each other's experience. And I really look forward to doing this in the digital age. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a wonderful and very rich speech. We've got a bit of time now to take some questions from the floor, but I wanted to take the privilege of the chair and ask you a first question. As is very clear from your speech, the digital world is well and truly a part of the Bobby's beat now, in all sorts of different and obvious ways. But I wanted to kind of ask you about a particular aspect of it. So we've seen, particularly in recent years, social media, Twitter, become a place where you see lots of threats, bullying, intimidation, abuse. You touched on it a bit in the sense where you said, well, you know, very quickly, arguments on Twitter can end up on the street. Mm-hmm. Is it only at the point when they end up on the street that becomes the business of the police, or are you increasingly finding yourselves having to police, in effect, on social media as well?
Well, certainly we do have crimes committed on social media. We have some pretty clear guidelines from our prosecutors as to what would amount to a crime in the online world. Of course, many people just want it to stop, and therefore, even if they report it to us as a crime and it does appear prima facie to be a crime, the best thing may well just be to work with the provider or help the individual to stop it from happening again. Equally, you know, there are preventative measures that providers can take, and that's increasingly, you know, something that a citizen will access directly and not bother us with what subsequently, if you looked at it, would appear to have been a crime. But of course, people do feel often that, as with other aspects of, you know, not online, disagreeable behaviour, often people will feel this shouldn't be allowed, or this is very unpleasant, or this is frightening me. But it doesn't amount to a crime. And actually, the bar is quite high. So we will tend, of course, we want to support somebody, give somebody some advice. But our job really is about dealing with law enforcement in this context, working with companies to help them to think about how they can prevent criminal behavior online. And then secondly, if it does happen, dealing with it. But so we frequently prosecute for online behavior, which amounts to harassment, or incitement to a crime, and particularly perhaps in the hate crime world, where you've got a protected characteristic, we have specific legislation around that, and it's not unusual. And you will have seen recently we've had some very vexed cases involving some of our members of parliament, and people have been brought to justice for online messaging of hatred and on the street. You know, hateful, disagreeable, and criminal behaviour. Getting very strong sentences because it kind of fundamentally, public life is undermined if people don't want to go into it. Judges will take a pretty firm view about a parliamentarian or a public figure being harassed in that way.
We'll take some questions from the audience. Please raise your hand and wait for the microphone. Just a question, please. So I've got a gentleman just down here.
Good evening. My name is Bill Bowman. Not that your job doesn't sound challenging enough already, but you mentioned Boris Johnson with the potential very soon of Brexit and perhaps a no-deal Brexit. Sure. Is that going to make your job even more challenging in terms of sharing data with nearby police forces?
Potentially, yes. This is something we have said continuously. We understand completely that this is just one thing to be thought about in relation to a very, very large and complex issue. So we've been thinking about a number of different things for a long time, clearly, in relation to Brexit. We do our absolute best to stay out of, and it's a long-established tradition of British policing, we try and stay out of politics as far as we can, party politics in particular, or issues that are hugely party politicised, we try to stay out of. But of course, if we're asked a question, we'll answer it as honestly and straightforwardly as we can. And it is the case that we currently have access, as I mentioned, to data, some systems, that in the absence of a deal in the short term, it would seem likely we won't be able to. So we have been looking at what alternative arrangements there may be, what risk appetite we would have for dealing with things in a different way. So some things will just not be able to be done anymore. Other things will be able to be done but be slower, which might bring more risk or more expensive. And we've been, talking really closely with our partners in all of the EU countries about how we can make alternative arrangements after a deal. This is not, going to bring the country to a halt. I do not want to overstate this at all. It brings challenges. We've got a new unit, which is doing nothing but making sure that we can get our international work with EU countries as slick as it can be in the future. If we don't have European arrest warrants, if we don't have access to criminal records in the same way, of course, that, this is exactly what we do with many other countries in the world anyway. But London is an international city, We have, at any one time, probably somewhere between 35 and 40% of our people in custody will be overseas foreign nationals. That's normal. That's proportionate to London. In fact, I think the foreign nationals are slightly better behaved than the Londoners, probably. Of those, maybe 50% would be EU citizens. So, you know, as a cop, you always want to know more, have more, greater understanding, and be able to do it faster and share data as best as possible. Some of those things are going to change. But rest assured, London's a very safe city. It will remain so, and we will get on with it.
Thank you. Hello, hi. I'm Melissa Jarding. I'm wanting to know about what progress is being made towards a public health approach to violence prevention, particularly knife crime, and how technology might be used to support that.
Yeah, great question. So the phrase public health approach, I'm not sure how sort of commonly used it is here. It's a phrase that means lots of things to different people, unfortunately, rather obviously. So it's lots of people, when they hear it, think this means involving the health service in preventing, let's say, knife crime. Other people think it means it's a disease. It has, or it's a sort of epidemic. It has epidemiological characteristics, and therefore we should sort of treat it in the same way. I see it rather more simply as a public health approach is basically saying prevention is better than cure, and in order to prevent, you have to bring in a huge range of agencies. What I see us doing in London is, in the last year or so, we've reduced moped-enabled crime by 50%, acid attacks have come right down, knife crime under 25, which was the issue that was really concerning Londoners, down by 20%. We've been, if you like, suppressing through some pretty hefty law enforcement activity. Sophisticated, using technology, but law enforcement activity. And what the public health approach suggests, and it's part of the government strategy, it's part of the mayor's strategy, is that you intervene as early as you can to try to prevent youngsters. We have some real, really young people getting engaged in this, but even younger than that, from getting involved. You think about the protective factors and the risk factors that they may have in their lives, try and enhance the protective factors, reduce the risk factors, and engage children's services, health services, schools particularly have a massive role to play in a public health approach to keep children safe before they get dragged into crime. It's a long-term approach. So our politicians a couple of times have been laughed at for saying this will take 10 years. But I think people who know about it say, obviously a public health approach is a long-term approach. But our job, is to get out there on the streets, target the most dangerous people, target the most dangerous places, and do everything we can in our bit to try to stop young people getting dragged into what is mostly drug-related, drug trafficking-related knife crime. I think if you looked at the strategies, you'd see a lot. And now if you look at the stuff that's being delivered and the amount of money that's going into it in London and across the UK, there's an enormous amount happening. But it will take time to have a real effect, albeit there's some good examples, for example, in Wales, in Cardiff and elsewhere, where they're quite a long way down the road.
Thank you. My name is Hugh McDermott. I'm a member of the New South Wales Parliament. In my experience prior to going into Parliament with law enforcement, organised crime is obviously always ahead of us when it comes to technology. So the question I have for you, as a parliamentarian, as a policymaker, what do you think is the most effective way of us getting legislation as being aware of what is going on and a way forward to making it actually work so that the legislation can keep up with the technology and can be assistance to law enforcement?
Goodness, that's a very interesting question. I don't feel very well qualified to answer it. I'm sure other people in the room would have a better answer, frankly. But I haven't really mentioned the industry very much in the private sector. And it's kind of extraordinarily obvious that we all have to work very closely with the industries and with the private sector, both the private sector who are now using exploiting new technologies, but also those who want to develop them. And for somebody like me, you know, from my background, with my age, you know, I find it quite hard to envisage what might be coming down the road and what it will look like. And I find it even harder to envisage what I might need. And in the old kind of analog age, you tended to say, you know, I want one of these. And that will stop that, won't it? And now we need to say, I want to have this effect against that technology or against that manifestation of that crime problem. And you can only do that if you work much more bravely close with the public, the private sector than I think we probably have done historically in the UK. I say bravely because I think we have to share our problems, share our risks, share our sometimes our secrets, obviously not personal data inappropriately, but sometimes our secrets in a way that we haven't always wanted to in the past. Secondly, you're right. Of course, organised criminals have always been ahead in one way or another. You know, and some of what we call new crimes, you know, they're not new. When I started policing in Western Central in 1983, we had human trafficking. Of course, we did. We had children sexually exploited who'd run away from home. We absolutely did. And it's organised criminals who are behind it then. It's organised criminals who are behind it now. And now they're using technology. I think, you know, you have to continue to use some quite old-fashioned methods. So my view, you have to penetrate organised crime groups. You have to get inside them and understand them. And you don't just ask them, you know, what... You don't just ask your sources, whether they are undercover officers or they are human sources, you know, what crime are they going to commit next? You want to ask some strategic questions about what are they doing technologically? What are they making most use of? Where are they going on the dark net now? You know, I saw the other day that when did we invent, whoever it was that invented cryptocurrencies, about 5 years ago, was it? We've now got 1,000. Well, some are being used a lot more than others, and we need to know which, and we need to know where it's going next. But obviously, a lot of them used very legitimately, I should be clear. But they're being used by organised criminals all the time. So you've got to be amongst them to understand where they're heading technologically. But I think my point about actually, you know, police are short, nothing much changes in a way. The motivation, money, revenge, sexual pleasure, these kinds of things don't change. And you've got to get yourself... You know, we all have to get ourselves a bit into the heads of the criminal.
I wanted to finish off this evening by asking you, we've talked a lot about digital, I wanted to ask you an analogue question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your speech that most of the Met's police officers are unarmed.
Sure.
That increasingly seems like the outlier when you think about other kind of police forces around the world. And in fact, a lot of police forces seem to be being up-armed, if anything. Mm. Would you ever conceive of a day when that situation in the UK would change with the Met, where most of your officers would be armed?
I think I can, but I could when I joined in 1983 as well. So it's quite striking that we haven't yet and that... You know, we had a police officer killed, sadly, on duty just a few weeks ago in a neighbouring force to mine. It's very rare, thank God, for a police officer to be murdered in the UK. Very, very rare. Very infrequent. But we are, as other people no doubt are, we are seeing, you know, assaults and some quite serious ones on occasion, absolutely. There's quite a high level of concern about officer safety in the UK at the moment. I've often thought the kinds of combination of things that might just make people feel this is what absolutely needs to happen now when we're talking about using, you know, lethal firearms. But most police chiefs in the UK and vast swathes of the public, I think, are still convinced. I know sometimes this is seen as a sort of old-fashioned quirky thing the English do. Actually, we see it as a really important part of our philosophy about how we work with our communities. We're fortunate that we don't have high availability of firearms in the UK. And since I've been a senior police officer, I've said it again and again. Your job is to bear down on violent crime, suppress firearms, get rid of firearms by criminal use, by whatever method lawfully you can, and work at improving the confidence of your communities, work at improving trust all the time. The more you do, you know, strong enforcement operations, the more you have to increase the trust and understanding of your communities and why you're there and why you're doing it.
So we're lucky that we have relatively low availability of firearms. But I look across what we call the pond, and I think, goodness me, you know, the number of officers shot with their own firearm, the number of officers killed by assailants, the in parts really appalling relationships between public and police. We pride ourselves that we are not in those kinds of relationships. I don't want to speak ill of you know, colleagues or communities elsewhere in the world. But I think for us, we believe that we would actually bring more violence upon our officers in the long run if we went to a fully armed service. However, there's a very live debate at the moment about the other officer safety methods, and we've got lots. You know, I'm just introducing spit guards for bike guards for all our officers. We're changing our baton, it's improving. We're bringing Parva spray instead of CS, and I've already increased the volume of Taser by about 50% since I became commissioner, and there's a big pressure to increase that again from many, many people. So it will go on developing, but it will be a very sort of a very definite and very big step for us to go to universal arming of the police. And as I say, I thought it was foreseeable in 1983. I still think it's foreseeable. I hope I don't see it happen.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you'll agree. It's been a real treat this evening to hear from the Commissioner an incredibly rich speech touching on a whole range of issues from digital to more analogue ones. Please join me in thanking Commissioner Cressida Dick.